accession number 20457, reel 7.
Brigadier Randall, reel 7. You were talking about the division being in the Imphal area.
Yes, well, they were up in the Chin Hills area. Imphal was reckoned, at one sense, not to be a good area to continue our training as a reconnaissance battalion.
Why is that?
I'm not quite sure, really, why. Because it was, as it turned out, it was the area that was going to be a major battle. I really don't know, but anyway, they decided it wasn't. So we were sent, to our great delight, up to a minor hill station called Shillong, which, to my mind, wasn't any better from training point of view than Imphal, but it was up at 6,000 feet. It was a lovely, cool, pleasant sort of place. And so we went up there for 6 months.
What was the ground like where you had been training at Ranchi? Was it...
Oh, that was really the sort of plains of India. That was really open sort of stuff. That wasn't a good place. Again, Imphal was... The actual Imphal plain is open paddy and that sort of thing, so I suppose that really wasn't a very good idea. Shillong had a bit more cover. But we were very much left alone. Nobody sort of set us a test exercise. We had one highlight when we were at Ranchi in that Wavell, who was then Commander-in-Chief, said he was going to visit the battalion, and we were all saying he was going to come at, say, 10 o'clock. Well, then suddenly at 10 minutes to 10, the guardroom rang up and said the Commander-in-Chief has arrived. And we gathered after that he did this deliberately. Anyway, I sort of told the colonel, he said, God, get D Company on parade. And so I phoned D Company, who leapt on, and they came roaring on parade, rather like a lot of sort of Tartar horsemen. And Wavell sort of stood there, with it, in his rather taciturn sort of way, with his, looking at them with one eye. And then we thought, oh, my God, you know, this is it. We're going to get, Sears going to get sacked. The Admiral's going to get sacked. But he smiled, actually, and he said, well, not a great deal of skill, but bags of spirit. So we got away with that. But we were really much left, because really nobody knew very much. I mean, it was a completely new concept. We hadn't had mounted infantry. It hadn't been a feature of like, the Indian Army, not since the turn of the century. And so we had to evolve our own doctrine. We were told what the standard we were to get up to. Well, we didn't get a great deal of input into the sort of tactical situations in which we would have to operate.
Did you have recourse to any sources of historical information about the uses of mounted infantry?
Well, we tried to get what we could. We got something, a certain amount of books about with the mounted infantry in South Africa. We did have some Indian cavalry officers and sowars sent to help us to learn to ride. But again, we were rather groping in the dark, really, and we hadn't got any clear idea of you know exactly how we were going to operate.
It sounds like it wasn't really a divisional concept to give you a role.
No, I think the power that be decided that the division would have a reconnaissance battalion. It was rather the division saying, we must have a reconnaissance battalion and please provide us with one. I mean, I think they were given a reconnaissance battalion whether they liked it or not. I think that was the truth of the matter.
So you would then be, presumably, you'd be divisional troops rather than part of the...
We were going to be... the 17th Indian Division was formed into a light division.
What did that mean?
Well, it meant that there were only two divisions, that the artillery was on a light... We had a mountain regiment. The field artillery had to be adapted onto jeep axles and things, so it could go on jeep tracks. We had some heavy mortars, so that it hadn't got quite the same fire. There's no medium artillery envisaged supporting it, so it was on a less formidable force. There's only two brigades on light scales than it would be if it had been a standard division of three brigades, but I think it was thought that this was a better organisation for going back into Burma. I think the idea of proved to be so. I mean, I think the idea of putting 25 pounders on jeeps was an excellent idea, and it worked certainly up in the Chin Hills. I mean, it made all the difference. They wouldn't have got quads and the normal mounting up at some of the places where artillery was able to go and support us. But then the Chin Hills was a one-off thing. I mean, when we got back to Imphal and going back into Burma, I mean, we were back on the standard axles and the standard towing vehicles because they could give you the speed of movement and so on. The fact remains that a division with three brigades is a better fighting force than one with two. Because you've got... is that going to worry us? And we haven't got the same reserve then, too, because, I mean, a division's got to have two brigades up. Well, then you've got no reserve then. So after the Battle of Imphal, during most of the Battle of Imphal, 17 Div had to have a brigade of 20 in Div anyway. So to be effective, so that a light division in those terms was not what was wanted.
While you were doing this training and so on, what were your main roles day to day? Were you dealing mainly with paperwork?
Well, the adjutant inevitably is a bum follower. There was a great deal to catch up in records and all that sort of business. And of course, as soon as you get out, you get a flow of paper coming in for brigade. They want to return on everything under the sun. Every morning I used to meet the colonel at 7 o'clock in the morning on my horse, and we'd hack out to see the training and that sort of thing. And discipline, we court-martialed those chaps I mentioned who had deserted in Burma, and that took a great deal of anything to do with military law has to be very meticulous and accurate, and that took time. Well, it's interesting, really, because a lot of us were of the view, and I think we were wrong, looking back now as a chap with more experience of military life, we thought we should close ranks and not wash our dirty linen in public. But our new CO who'd come in said, I don't agree with this. We have got to let it know once and for all that desertion is the most heinous crime any soldier can commit. And we're not going to put up with it in this battalion. So we court-martialed them, and I was involved in all that. And the leader was actually sentenced to death. It was commuted by the viceroy. But old Pat Lindsay, my CO, said, well, we're going to lay this on. And so we had the whole battalion formed up in three sides, and this guilty holder was marched on in chains with a sort of low beat of drums. It was all sort of stuff you'd never get away with today. And then I had to read it out. And he said, I want you to read it out in Urdu. And when he said, sentenced to death, I want you to pause then. And it was quite dramatic, and they read it out. And then there was a sort of, the hell, but there was a sort of, it's not exactly a sigh, but a gasp. It was quite dramatic, actually. And then I had to read out, but the as commuted it. And the Havildar just stood there, and he just sort of, he didn't spit at me, but he just spat. I must say, to give him his dues. He was commuted to penal servitude for life. Looking back, the colonel was right. We never had a single desertion ever because, as I said earlier, one of the mainsprings of the Indians' philosophy of soldiering was the idea of honour. And anybody who'd been court-martialed for desertion would be a figure of a pariah, a figure of disgrace in his village. And this hammered it home, particularly amongst men who couldn't read or write. So the colonel was absolutely right.
Did you ever have any other instances of that sort of theatrical behaviour to make points to the soldiers? Not necessarily for disciplinary reasons, but for training reasons.
Not quite like that, no. There were some fond farewells at the end, you know, when people left. But this was a very dramatic moment, and he made his point. And I think every soldier, everybody there, every officer, every soldier there, will probably remember that.
It's often said that when you're training British soldiers, one of the best ways is to make training into a sort of game, particularly if you can make it competitive.
Yes.
Did you apply the same sort of technique?
Well, I think, yes. I think that's true of soldiers of any race, really. Certainly, within, yes, I think that is right. It's not always entirely easy, but we certainly encourage horsemanship by having gymkhanas with pillow fighting on horses, and we used to take on the mountain gunners, but they had bloody great mules. And then we used to do tent pegging and that sort of thing. Oh, who's that?
Come in.
Yes, and we used to pillow fighting and wrestling, but we only had what were called infantry mules, class 2 mules, up to about 12 hands. They had huge, the mountain artillery mule has to carry this whacking great mountain gun broken down. They were much bigger and stronger, and they were better horsemen. So we didn't come off very well in gymkhanas, but it all encouraged horsemanship and that sort of thing. But of course, the sheer burden looking after animals, it's not like a car. You put it into the garage. You might just have to check the water, but you switch off and go home. Not with an animal. It's got to be fed and watered and cleaned out, and then you've got to clean the saddle, clean the saddle and all. So the sheer sort of sheer administrative burden of a soldier's day was that much more onerous because he had animals to look after.
Have you any idea of roughly what proportion or percentage of their time, day to day, was spent looking after their animals?
Well, I would say about 2 hours a day, purely on, obviously in war you might not do that, but normally speaking, in the morning you've got to get up. Because they weren't in stables, they were tethered out in the open. But you've got to have some sort of sanitation. You can't just leave the dung around, so their head would be sort of shoveled up and dealt with, and then the animal had to be groomed a bit. Otherwise, if it had been out, it had been rain during the night or something, it had to be groomed and looked after, and then it had to be fed and watered. Then they had to sort of look at it, the usual business, looking at its feet and that sort of thing. And then if it was going out on parade, it had to be saddled up and things. So that was a good hour in the morning, and then in the evening again, they had to be unsaddled, groomed again, fed and looked after. So 2 hours a day really was, we say, non-effective. It was just maintaining the horse, quite apart from the chap himself having his meals and cleaning his own rifle and that sort of thing. So it was quite a busy old day really for the soldiers.
Cuts into the training time.
It does, absolutely, yes.
Did you have a good supply of horses?
Yes, we got a heterogeneous sort of. We had some Indian ponies, but a lot came up from South Africa, from Basutu ponies, which were quite good. And we got some whalers from Australia. So they all came through, I think, a place called Saharanpur. There was sort of a major remount depot. I mean, they didn't come direct to us. But a lot of them hadn't really been broken. I mean, they'd only been broken in certain amount. So we had quite a bit of business with the horses sometimes, you know, getting them used to just putting a bridle on and being saddled up. They weren't trained cavalry troop horses by any means.
Did you actually do cavalry drills with your...
No. I mean, we had the sort of normal business, prepare to mount and that sort of thing, and then the other one, make much of your horses. But we didn't make the mistake of trying to become cavalry. I mean, we realized that the horse was only the means of transporting you about, and that having got into the battlefield area, we were still operating as infantry.
What about the jeeps? How was their maintenance and repair dealt with? Did you have some sort of specialist attachment?
Well, I think we had it was still ROC now, just about that time when the ROC handed over and REMI was formed and EMI was formed. I think we had a sort of buffed up LAD. We certainly had quite a lot of EMI personnel.
Were these your own men who you trained up?
Well, no. I think they were EMI chaps. I mean, every battalion had some EMI, but I think we had a... Because we had a lot of vehicles, we were given extra vehicle mechanics and associated personnel. But then again, that was quite a training just to teach them to drive and then maintain them. So it was a very busy time, really. I mean, people were really working quite hard, which isn't a bad thing in war. I mean, you expect to.
Was there any facility for recreation when you weren't actually working?
Well, certainly it was for the officers, but the men, of course, the Indian soldier was never so much dependent upon welfare. This is one of the great easy things about it. The Indian soldier, because he lived a simple life in the village, was a great chap for making his own amusements. And they'd be perfectly happy playing a bit of football or volleyball was a great popular game, because you can play that on a small bit of ground. They'd play that, and then they'd be fine, they'd have a good meal. They'd sit around in the evenings talking. They're great talkers, great storytellers. All this went on. And they'd smoke their hookers, smoke endless, bloody awful, cheap Indian cigarettes, and just talk away until they went to sleep. But they had a pretty full day. They had a good meal and a fag on. They turned in quite early, because we were in a tented camp, so there wasn't any electric light, so there were just hurricane lamps, and so chaps were only too happy to get their head down really quite early.
And what about the officers?
Well, because it was a hill station, the officers could play, go to the club. There were white women about. There were also some particularly attractive native girls about. A bit of golf.
So your golf clubs did come in handy.
Well, those golf clubs, you mentioned that. Funnily enough, it's a funny story. Those golf clubs, somehow or other, survived an ambush. And then this new colonel came in, and he said, look, I'm not going to have those golf clubs around. So he issued all the golf clubs out to battalion headquarters in the retreat. I was commanding a company then, but whenever you saw battalion headquarters, you could see the sort of subedar major and people all walking along with these golf clubs. And when we got back to Imphal, Colonel said to me, by the way, John, let's get all those golf clubs in. They might be useful. And we got them all in. And then he said, who had the number 7 iron? And I said, well, Lance Knox. He said he'd broken it. Disgraceful. We'll have him on a charge. I thought for a moment he was serious. Anyway, those golf clubs survived the retreat. God knows what happened to them, but I certainly, I got some of my own. Sorry, that's a rather silly digression.
You didn't have them much longer,
though. I had some golf clubs there. I had some of my own. I think that they'd gone back to the depot in 41, and I had them sent up. I'm a bit vague about that. Anyway, we played a bit of golf up there, and we were in the club and that sort of thing. And of course, we went on leave. We had quite given leave, and that sort of thing. We went off to the hill stations for leave, and that sort of thing.
What was going on the larger scale while you were doing this training?
Well, the 17th Division was up in the Chin Hills. The first Wingate expedition had gone in.
Did you hear about that at the time?
Well, when we moved up, end of 42, beginning of 43, we saw a lot of, anyway, some stage, we saw a lot of the first Wingate chaps coming out, and we weren't frightfully impressed by that. I mean, they were in a terrible condition, with a very low morale, and it didn't, I mean, they came out in a far worse shape than we did coming out in 42. That didn't impress us very much. Then, of course, the first Arakan went on, and that was a bit of a shambles, and very unsuccessful. When we were finally moved up from Shillong back up through Imphal up to the Chin Hills, we weren't quite certain what things were going to go. We thought we were going up in the Chin Hills to launch an attack into Burma. I think that had originally been the idea. But then, of course, strategically, the Japanese planned their assault on Kohima, Imphal, before the 14th Army had got their thing going. And then, of course, the second Chindit operation was going on, which absorbed a great deal of resources, particularly in air transport. And so, I'm not sure, we were quite sure exactly what the immediate future held.
How much warning did you have that you were going to be moved forward again into
the... I think we were given quite good adequate warning. It's an immensely complicated business moving over, because you see, we did move our animals a certain amount of the time by night march. I mean, they occupy the road so that we did all these night marching, which is very... You don't really get the full sleep in the daytime. Then we did have to load them sometimes into a tray. It takes a very long time to load 500 or 600 animals into a train. Mules are very stubborn, and getting them into these sort of open wagons, it took about 3 weeks or so, nearly a month to get us... Yes, and when we moved from Ranchi up in the beginning of 43, I mean, we had to load them all onto paddle steamers on the Brahmaputra, and that was another very, very time-consuming business. And of course, you're not very popular because 900 animals come along, and they're defecating everywhere, lots of flies and things. So, you know, it's not an easy thing to move, or wasn't under those conditions anyway, to move a mixed battalion of horses and vehicles. It took a long, long time, and the roads, of course, were only that one road up, and we were taking up a lot of road space, so mostly night moves and that sort of thing.
Why night moves?
Simply so we didn't block up the road for day movement, because that was the route from Dimapur up through Kohima was the only LFC, and all the rations, movement, and everything was on that one road, because air transport hadn't really got going. And so if a reconnaissance battalion was on the march, we would be blocking with all those animals. We would be blocking the road all day.
How many miles of road would you occupy?
Oh, goodness me, I don't know. I would think a couple of miles anyway.
Were you responsible for setting out the order of march?
Well, the adjutant did the staff work, yes. So that kept me quite busy. I got, unfortunately, I got jaundice in the middle of it. quite badly and had to be shipped out back to Shillong to recover. So I only personally was involved in about half the move.
How long did that take you to recover from the jaundice?
Well, I had it very badly, and then I got a week's or 10 days sick leave, and then I think they said you ought to go back to the depot, and I said, no, I want to go back to my battalion, and the CO was keeping the slot open.
Do you know how you managed to catch jaundice? Was it prevalent at the time?
Yeah, I think I must have got it through some food, I think, really. I don't really know. It was quite prevalent, though, and I think you only had to have a bit of infected food. It wasn't... fortunately, it wasn't the killer one. There's A and B, aren't there? No, I can't remember. It wasn't... Yeah, but I went very, very yellow, and I felt really, very ill, and I was really quite ill and sorry for myself. And they said you mustn't drink for 9 months or something, but I ignored that because there were times in the Battle of Imphal when I'd rather die than not have a glass of grog. My health, I've never suffered from it. I get a bit liverish in the mornings. So I didn't rejoin the battalion until they were up in the Chin Hills. So I only half that very complicated move was I involved in.
When you're moving like that on the road, how far could you move during the night march?
Well, I'm trying to think now. Night movement's not really... I think we were only moving... We probably set off just about dark, about 7, and we had about 6 or 7 hours. We didn't do much more than 15, 20 miles at the most. And then we had to be shunted off the road into a sort of bivouac area to keep the road clear. And then we sort of slept, caught up on our sleep, looked after the animals.
So you're lying up in the day and moving.
Well, that's right.
Did they have bivouac areas pre-prepared, or did you have to find your own?
Well, they just said, milestone so-and-so, and the advance party chap went up there. I mean, in that sort of general area, he picked the best spot he could find within a mile or two, really. And of course, some were good and some bad, but you had to spread the animals out and that sort of thing. So it involved a lot of detailed minor staff work, and it was a very time-consuming business, really.
Were they sort of laid out in proper lines and so forth in bivouac areas?
Oh, no. I mean, a bit vague about it now. I mean, I don't think we even had bivouac. I think we just slept out in the open, really. I mean, I think the CO had a tent. We probably put a tent up down here just in case, just to stop the paper flying about. But I think most of us just kept on. It was in the open. So, I mean...
What sort of bedding did you have for kipping down?
Well, the soldiers just had ground sheet and a blanket. That's all they had. I think I had a camp bed, one of these sort of folding camp bed things.
One of the collapsible wooden ones.
Yeah, well, those originally, the sort of canvas ones.
Yeah.
And then later on they had those ones with sort of bits of sort of prongs of sort of spongy steel.
Metal struts.
Which were quite good, really. You were tired anyway, you could sleep anywhere. I could sleep on those days I could sleep on the ground, any damn thing, really.
What about the feeding?
Well, it was the Indian soldier again was very much more sort of the strange thing. Right, administration in the things you have to worry about looking after British soldiers about didn't seem to worry you then. I mean, I left virtually all that sort of thing to my subedar, and they were so used to it that they could. An Indian can cook a meal almost in a hurricane on a glowworm, really.
They cook by companies or
you cook by company. You had a company, Lunga, and you had your company cooks. But they could get a fire going anywhere. And with this dal, they just heated that up with a bit of water and then made the old chapatis. But you never seem to have to worry about that. You didn't have to start thinking about... as an officer, sighting the latrines or... Of course, you had very good VC. They were so good, so experienced. All the business about oil, resupply of ammunition. You didn't have to worry about it. Reloading.